I don't know how different this is going to be from other interviews you've done, but we speak in depth and we speak about the moral and ethical implications of the subject. And what I would like to do is spend most of our time talking about the book you've just written and what that means, and mm-hmm. and also talk about some of the larger issues and how you're thinking about what's happening in our world. I mean, you know, you were one of your chapters in the when you're doing the harvesting of the turkeys that Hurricane Katrina was happening, and I want to talk mm-hmm. about not just this subject, but the larger context of what's happening in the society and the world as you process mm-hmm. these experiences. Mm-hmm. Now, mm-hmm. I mean, I would like to start in a place that I do start all my conversations. Everyone I interview is not religious, and they're religious in very different ways. But mm-hmm. I do like to start by asking if there was a religious aspect to your childhood, a religious background to your life.
Okay, are we actually starting?
I think we are. stop if you're having trouble with that, with the echo again.
Okay. So mm-hmm. you just asked that question.
Okay. Yeah. And also, this is not live. You know, we'll edit it later, so right. it gets to be a real conversation.
Right. Okay. I would say that I was raised with very strong spiritual values. And that means, as opposed to material values, mm-hmm. understand that spiritual matters are always more important than material things, as long as you have enough to eat. When you right. don't, then material things matter more than anything,
right,
I guess.
Right.
But we did. And I was raised in a rural place where I think community values and a kind of a community standard of giving and being responsible to one's neighbors was really the most important thing. And it seems to me that every book I write really returns to that. The question of how an individual can be oneself and still remain conscious of one's debt to the community.
Now, I do want to say, tell you that I think The Poisonwood Bible is one of the great novels of our time. And I quote from it in a book that I just published. And I know that's not our subject today, but I am intrigued in this context of these spiritual values that you just mentioned and your love and knowledge of the natural world. You studied evolutionary biology. That you did spend 2 years, or was it 2 years in Africa when you were a girl?
It was a bit less than that. Yeah, okay. I always say I went to Africa instead of second grade.
Okay. And, I'm just curious, if, as you look back on that, how that influenced what you just described, your sense of spirituality and also your sense of the natural world.
Oh, I have no doubt that it changed me forever, because as a 7-year-old, I had my eyes open to the fact that people live in incredibly different ways the world over, and a lot of them live without plumbing or electricity, and that in one culture, people who describe themselves as poor might be considered fabulously wealthy right. in another, but the more materially depauperate of those two cultures is not necessarily the worse off. Mm-hmm. Could be, but not necessarily. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting to me also to live as a minority. We were the only white people in the village where we lived, and the only white children that a lot of people had seen, and that was really good for me too, to understand what that's like to be stared at and to have people make presumptions about me because of the color of my skin. That was an indelible change for me. And so I came back home to our little town in Kentucky to live in a different way, I have no doubt. I didn't really think about it very much at the time, but as soon as I began thinking about social responsibility and reading more broadly, I read in high school the Doris Lessing novels from the Children of Violence series, which are all about civil rights, the apartheid in Rhodesia, and the place where she grew
up.
And, right, and women's issues and racial equality. And I suppose became more aware of all of those issues than most children.
Right. Well, you had for reading that most American children wouldn't have.
Yeah, I think that's true. Mm-hmm. I wrote that book. I wrote The Poison Wood Bible for other reasons. I always wanted to write a big novel about imperialism and attitude and carrying attitudes from one place to another. This is funny. I'm straying from the subject of the book.
Oh, okay. Well, all right.
Anyway,
we'll come back to that a little bit
okay.
at the end.
Okay.
Well, let me just, say, for example, last year I interviewed Wangari Maathai, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, who is a great Kenyan environmentalist. Mm-hmm. And she talked to me about drought and encroaching desert. And I think that those very dramatic manifestations of whatever's happening to climate in our time, we think of as happening in a place like Africa. But you, in fact, the story you tell in your new book takes place, begins as you are leaving the American desert of Tucson.
Yeah, Tucson, Arizona.
And I think that you suggest that you were also in that place facing climate change and kind of an unsustainable ecology in the face. In fact, what we think of as a very successful American city.
It's true. People are moving to the Sun Belt in droves, but I was becoming increasingly conscious of it as of my city as something like a space station, because every unit of food that people consume there had to be moved in from someplace else. The water was moved there from somewhere else. It didn't exactly belong to us in the most biological sense. And I didn't feel comfortable with that. We moved to southwestern Virginia for a lot of reasons. It's very near where I grew up in Kentucky. We were really coming home,
right,
to be near extended family, and we had planned to move to this farm for a very long time. So it wasn't that we fled the desert because we didn't love it anymore. I don't want to say that. We did. But when we made this move, we were very conscious of how we were going to a place that could sustain us in a different way, and we undertook this project to try to really live in a sustainable way and get our food locally and attend to our local food chain. And we did that because of a feeling of sort of an obligation to a lot of community values, the farming community, the farming economy, and also the biological community and the world that we live in.
But, you tell this story, in between your story, you tell the story of how we as a culture got to this place that we don't live on a food that is grown around us, and that we've even lost we don't even know that.
we've forgotten even to ask the question, where did our food come from? It doesn't even seem to bother us that most of our food may have come from China or Argentina or a combination of the two milled together in some third location, that so much of our food travels great distances to reach us using an enormous amount of fossil fuels, leaving an enormous carbon footprint, while at the same time we're turning our backs on the farmers who may be struggling to survive in our own region. We're not doing it on purpose.
Right. We don't even know.
Forgotten how to think about it. We've forgotten even how to ask, how to look for what's in season at this moment. Mm-hmm. And that's really the main thing we wanted to address in this book, to just gently tell a story that would nudge people back into their own food system a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it was interesting to me to hear that this practice of eating fruits and vegetables that were grown in faraway California was originally, you know, a luxury for very rich people, right? That they might have, I don't know, an orange at their dinner table.
Yeah, it was like a party trick, mm-hmm. to produce lettuce in the middle of winter in the Midwest. Just a handful of people could afford it. Mm-hmm. And it was probably considered bizarre by the neighbors, who were much more sensible. And to tell you the truth, humans, for all of history until right around the time of World War II, have eaten locally, local organic food that was produced sustainably. That's a normal way to eat. And it's kind of funny that in just a couple of generations, we have come so far from that returning to it is something special that has a name.
What is that name?
Well, they're
eating locally.
People, yeah, eating uh-huh. locally. Uh-huh. Or locavores were called now. It's funny, when we began this project, there wasn't any name for it, but mm-hmm. now people speak of locavores.
Well, you know, here is an irony I would articulate. As you say, you've written a book about spending 1 year with your family doing something that feels astonishing and even privileged, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it the time that you had, the space in your life, the security, the choice to move to this other home, and yet you're writing about something. You're writing about a way of living that, as you say, is the way human beings lived forever, and I suppose most people in the world still live as a matter of survival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so it's pretty funny that in our culture, it's
very exotic what you did.
It is. I mean, it's so normal what we did, but there's also a kind of bias in our culture that we're eating organically and this local cuisine thing is elite, that it's mm-hmm. something that only privileged people can do. That's nonsense. It's really returning to what's normal for humans if we can regain some control over our own communities.
I'd like for you to explain something to me that I don't quite understand. You're right, it feels elite. And the truth is that although I think organic produce is more and more available and people are more aware of it and more people are buying it, it's still the expensive, it's an elite option in a sense. You talk a lot about the hidden costs of the food that's cheaper, that we've gotten used to, that comes from far away. I mean, why do those costs not turn up in my grocery bill and the cost of organic food does?
Because you're paying for them on a different tally, mostly through your taxes. The farm bill, which is renegotiated every 5 to 7 years, and in fact is being renegotiated right now, sets food policy in our country, and it gives billions and billions of dollars of subsidies to mostly producers of commodity crops. Wheat, corn, and soybeans that get turned into things like high fructose corn syrup mm-hmm. and feedlot grain for cheap hamburgers. So that makes these foods cheap. You're paying for it. You're just paying for it through your taxes. And also, we're paying for it through our children. We're creating an enormous environmental debt, which will have to be paid later because this kind of industrial agriculture, of course, erodes topsoil. It destroys water systems, and it does all kinds of damage to the land that can be repaired only slowly and expensively, if at all. Mm-hmm. So we're deferring a lot of the costs. But our policy that we vote for, that we ostensibly support through our elected legislators, our policy makes this kind of food, what we call junk food, makes it cheap, while organic growers have to pay out of their own pockets for their certification and their oversight.
Okay.
So policy makes those foods expensive. So we've reversed the order of things, and we're scratching our heads wondering why. If we care, we could address that and try to change our policy. Meanwhile, it's absolutely true that many people have extremely limited food choices in this country, and I do know that. There are large urban areas where people's only grocery option is a convenience market. But for those of us who do have other choices, who can go to the farmer's market, find local farmers, reward them for bringing in their produce, we improve the odds that more people can afford it and that it will expand into other areas. There are, in a city near where I live, for example, there's a vegetable bookmobile, essentially.
Really?
It's a farmer's market on a school bus that drives around in the low-income neighborhoods and sells vegetables at a very reasonable cost. So if we want it, if we support it, these things can change.
Hmm. You obviously went into this with a tremendous amount of knowledge and planning. You'd always been a gardener. You knew about farming, and you're a scientist. But I wonder, and you write about the year in great detail in the book, but I wonder if you could just say, you know, what surprised you the most about that, the experience when you were actually living it?
I think what surprised me the most is that we didn't really miss anything. Mm-hmm. We went into it probably thinking too much about what we weren't not going to be able to have. You know, oh my goodness, no strawberries in January. You know, it's easy to get hung up on what you don't have. Everybody knows that. But when we changed our thinking and began started every meal with the question, what do we have? What's coming in right now? What's in season? What do we have plenty of? It became really a long exercise in gratitude. It was so much fun, and it was so reinforcing to the culture of our family. I think food culture and the way we look at food in this country has so much to do with why we acquiesce to a complete loss of control of our food system and our food sources. In our culture, we generally lack strong regional traditions of food that tie us to our place and our people. You know, specific food traditions as they have in Italy, for example, or in India or Mexico or really almost anywhere. We seem to be a little at sea in this country as a result when it comes to food rules. And I think that we're behaving as if we're in search of some kind of food Leviticus to save us from the simple roil of cheap fats and carbohydrates. I mean, honestly, I mean, if you look at the bookstore shelves, they're crammed with diet books.
Yes. And I wanted to note this, that it's right. When we talk about correcting this knot we're in and addressing obesity and all of that, we talk about replacing bad habits with habits that are good for you.
It's the language of sin.
Yes.
It's as if we are afraid of our food.
Right.
Which is reasonable enough because we don't know it. How can we trust it if we don't know what hemisphere it came from?
But you know that in the arena of food, the ethical choice is also the pleasurable choice.
In this case, it is. I'm really in favor of throwing out this language of sin and talking about being bad when you're sitting down to a good meal, because the ethical choice of supporting your local farmer, getting rid of the fossil fuel guzzling, you know, industrial pipeline, also tastes better.
Right.
And it does involve cooking, but that's also such a wonderful thing to come home to. I think that the planning of beautiful meals and investing one's heart and time in their preparation is the opposite of self-indulgence. Kitchen-based family gatherings are so nourishing and soulful.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that delight in cooking, the art of it and the pleasure of it comes through so clearly in your book and right now in your voice as you're talking about it. But for me, where what that touches on is another drought in American life, and that is the drought of time, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it sounds to me like you, I know you were probably writing, but you were really able to be present to your garden, to your home, to your family, to that lifestyle, and that is something that feels unattainable to me, and I think a lot of people who just feel like we're just working and juggling children is tricky.
Well, you know, I was doing that too. I've been a working mother for 20 years, mm-hmm. So I don't remember any other way of being. And I didn't write about writing in the book, but I'm at my desk pretty much 8 to 5 every day, like so many other people. I do have an easy commute, there's no doubt. Yeah. But my work life is profoundly consuming and often difficult and frustrating. And so for me, walking away from my desk job at 5 o'clock and or 5:30 or 6 or whenever, and going out to the garden and just taking a hoe to some weeds always feels so good. But this is work that I do mostly on the weekends and in evenings. Mm. And so is cooking. We do easy cooking in the weeknights and our more elaborate extravaganzas on the weekends, and certainly things like canning and putting up we do on summer weekends when we have friends over to help. And the thing is, we all have the same 24 hours in our days. It's a question of what we do with them. And, you know, of course, we don't have as much control over that as we'd like. But it's so interesting to me when I'm in Europe and spend time with my Spanish friends or Italian friends. And they're working people, too. They're women who work in offices or, you know, they're editors or laboratory scientists. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they're out of work, they head straight for the market. And they go down to see what fish has come in or what greens do they have now at this season. And even at high-powered business lunches with editors in France, this has happened to me so many times. These women in their fashionable shoes and business suits will stray from post-colonial literature over onto the subject of mushrooms. You know, and there's no shame in their enthusiasm for cooking. They feel that cooking for their families is a really important part of who they are. This, I think, is at the heart of the problem for a lot of us anyway. I think I belong to the generation of women who grew up thinking that walking away from the kitchen was walking away from some kind of slavery. You know, it's how
yes.
we think about
yes,
it.
Yes, you're right. If we thought of cooking as this great pleasure that we had to wait, that we could look forward to at the end of the working day, I suppose that would change it.
If mm-hmm. we look at it as family time, as entertainment, as spiritually enlightening, even, you know, if we looked at it as a destination rather than a rock in the road,
yes.
I think we would do more of it. And not every day, maybe not not on Monday nights, okay, but definitely on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And cooking, that is important. I mean, I really don't believe in telling anybody what to eat or what to do, but cooking is kind of the linchpin in the local eating equation. Oh boy, was that a mixed metaphor.
right. But it's not just about buying. It's not just about what you buy or where you buy it, but preparing it, right?
Taking it home mm-hmm. and making something
making
of it
yours.
Because local food consists of ingredients. It's not usually things with barcodes. And that's where the matter of expense comes in as well. When people think that eating healthy foods and organic foods is expensive, they're often looking at barcodes. But if you begin with simple whole foods and look at them as ingredients for making meals, you end up with a much lower cost. Mm. It's pretty generally affordable.
You know, I think I found one of the most moving chapters of the book when you describe harvesting the meat, as you say, because you're not just talking about growing vegetables. You also raised turkeys and roosters and killed them. And as you say, you know, you tell a story of at dusk sitting down to feast on cold bean salad, sliced tomatoes with basil, blue potato salad, and meat that had met this day's dawn by crowing. I mean, that is a part of what we eat. I don't know, even of just the fact of life and death that we American consumers are very removed from. Tell me what, when you say there's the big difference between talking about harvesting meat and the way we normally think about the meat.
Yeah,
we buy.
I used to think it was a euphemism to use that word harvest. I don't anymore. And it's funny, just now I reacted a little oddly when you said you raised chickens and then killed them. That word, if you think about it, the way we use it is a murder, a homicide.
Yes, well, we talk about slaughterhouses.
Murder. Well, or we say, oops, I killed my African violet. It suggests some accidental or intentionally mean-spirited act.
We're back at sin again, aren't we?
Yeah, we yes. are. Whereas harvesting a rooster is allowing this animal to achieve its final glory. It was hatched. It was born for one purpose on this earth. These varieties of animals were invented by humans. They're not wildlife. They were bred over centuries for the purpose of being food. And that is the legacy that they live for, frankly. They don't know it, but they don't know otherwise either. They really, I mean, I've spent a lot of time around poultry. They don't really have emotional affairs. They have... They have rights, I believe. I think they have the right to a dignified existence. I really enjoy seeing my turkeys out on pasture foraging, you know, living under the sunshine, living lives of essential turkeyness. And I hate thinking about the factory farm turkeys that are the kind you buy in the grocery store, which live in big metal warehouses just crammed as tightly as they can possibly be packed in, never seeing the sun in their entire four-month lives, bred for such docility and sort of large-breasted deformity. They can't fly or even reproduce. You know, I don't like that, and I frankly myself don't eat that kind of meat, although I know plenty of people do, without really thinking much about the history of that food. Myself, if I'm going to eat an animal, I want its life to have had some dignity, some you know, poultry joy, because I do believe there is such a thing, and for it to end its life with dignity and leave its legacy on the table. It's a peculiar thing. Another fascinating thing about our culture is that we confuse longevity with happiness. Turkeys don't want to live to be 100 years old. They don't want to know their grandchildren. Believe me, they couldn't pick their grandchildren out of a lineup. I know this for a fact.
You know, you make an interesting point that plants also live, that fruits and vegetables are also living things that we
they are
we and kill in a sense. Again, not to use that hard word, but but we don't think about that either.
I don't know anyone who does except me. I mean, I'm such a dope. I get sentimental about cutting the heads off the broccoli because I really enjoy the process of their lives, and yet I do realize that's what they're here for. But it is funny. We get all sentimental about cutting the heads off chickens, but not cutting the head of an onion into a million pieces. We also don't think twice about committing a willful streptococcus massacre. You know, if our kid is sick, we give them penicillin, and you know, that's a genocide on the microbial scale. But we don't worry about it.
But I mean, our culture, we don't like to think about death or mortality or finitude in general. I mean, what this makes me think of is that, in fact, we even translate that attitude we take to ourselves and our bodies. We've translated that into shutting our awareness of that aspect of our life of eating as well.
We do. And what it comes back down to is we just don't know it. Mm-hmm. Most people know animal life in only two forms. One is pets, which are junior people, let's face it. They're just, you know, they are members of the family. You can't imagine, you know, harvesting that. It's not appropriate. Or wildlife. But farm animals, livestock, are a third category of life with which most people really have no familiarity. Mm-hmm. And so it's very easy to project our own wishes and values onto these animals without really knowing whether that makes any sense or not.
Now, in the chapter in your book, Animal Vegetable Miracle, where you describe the day in which you harvested the animals, news was coming in of Hurricane Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how you experienced and kind of processed the larger implications of those events, perhaps differently because of that experiment you were conducting and living sustainably.
I think so much all the time about the effects of our consumption, and particularly the small, relatively small number of, particularly about the relatively small number of us in the world who are consuming the great majority of the world's resources, burning so much of the world's fossil fuels, contributing so much to global climate change, which is beginning to pound at our shores and the shores of many other countries. But we haven't felt the damage yet so much here, but we began to on that weekend. And it really felt like it was such a great sadness, because it felt like this this terrible coming home to roost. It became clear to me that the numbers up on this, the way that we consume, we have yet, it seems to me, in this country, we have yet to assign any moral value to the overconsumption of the world's limited resources.
Overconsumption.
Yeah. If you can afford it, it's okay to use it. Mm-hmm. That seems to be the only rule. That can't go on forever. And it's interesting to me that, let me think about how to say this. It seems to me that eating food that burns up a piece of the world and makes life... Okay, let me back up and say.
Okay, that's right. Take your time.
There are many, many paths toward finding a better and more sustainable way to live in the world. Some people do it by giving up meat. I did it by giving up bananas because when I think about all those fossil fuels that are burned in a refrigerated cargo hold to get that stuff to me, I didn't want to do that. That didn't seem cruelty-free to me.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to find another way to live I wanted to find another way to live that would brighten the prospects of my children's time on this earth.
I mean, here's something you wrote of Hurricane Katrina happening in the middle of this year. You wrote that analysts of current events were mostly looking to blame administrators. Fair enough, but there were also, it seemed, obvious vulnerabilities here. whole populations depending on everyday long-distance lifelines, supplies of food and water and fuel, and everything else that are acutely centralized. That's what we consider normal life. Now nature had written a hugely abnormal question across the bottom of our map. Say some more to me about what that abnormal question was.
Well, the question is, do you think you can keep doing this without paying some kind of a price? I don't know. I sort of finished the thought there in writing.
That's all right. And I also sense, now I'm looking at the sweep of your writing over, say, the last 10 years. It seems to me that September 11th also kind of formed the sense of urgency that you have now. You talked then about the prideful wastefulness as a nation. I think you just described that in more detail. Tell me, connect the dots. Oh, go on.
Well, sometimes I think it's prideful. Sometimes I think it's just clueless. Mm-hmm. I mean that to describe myself as much as anyone. We don't have a clue sometimes about how or what we're wasting. Mm-hmm. It's so easy for us to have, for example, foods that were grown on the other side of the world and brought to us without any idea who grew it, who worked for what low wage to harvest it, who had to breathe pesticides in order to put it on a truck. You know, those questions have, a curtain has been drawn over the whole process so that we've come to look at our food as a product. Mm-hmm. It isn't.
Those are moral questions.
It's all a process, and those are moral questions. If we care to look, to draw back the curtain and look, it isn't all bad news. There are ways to make this process a happier one that really serves our community instead of either ignoring it or damaging it. I think the subject of food seems daunting because there are so many different questions, so many different problems. And that's something that really compelled me about writing this book. I love to start with a huge, unanswerable, boggling kind of question and see if I can whittle it down into the shape of a really good yarn. You know, I just love to see if I can give it a plot and make you laugh all along the way and maybe make you cry at the end and create something that will invite you in. And then when you're finished and you close the book, maybe you'll step out into the world in a slightly different way and ask your own questions and answer them in your own way. I am so sorry.
That's all right.
That's so embarrassing. That's mine.
It's not the first time it's happened in history.
Okay.
All right.
Did I get the end
think,
there?
I think okay? You had finished the answer. I'm not exactly sure.
Okay. I think I just said and answer the questions in your own way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So that if we turn it into a story, stories help us make sense.
Oh, stories are the only thing that help us make sense. That's how human brains are constructed. We need a story. And I think all the oldest stories were how we taught the next generation not to make the stupid mistakes that we did. You know, where to find the food, where to find the water, and don't go here and don't fall in the hole and get bit by the snake. Stories are what we respond to.
And You know this fact of human life, that in a sense we experience the crises of our time to be completely new and original and uniquely catastrophic,
yes.
Right?
It's never been as bad.
Right,
it's never been as bad as it is right now.
The worst century, and then at the very same, on some level that may be true, and at the very same time we are reliving parables and stories that play themselves out with different variations over and over again in human life.
I think it's not true. I mean, certainly the environmental picture is bleaker and scarier now for humans than it's ever been before. But in almost every other way, we keep getting it a little more right. And yeah. When my kids feel gloomy about the headlines or, you know, sort of what kind of a mess humans have made of their own relations, I say, you know what? When I started first grade, the black kids weren't allowed to go to my school. They didn't even have a school. They went to a church up the hill. Our schools were segregated in second grade. And when you got on an airplane, the person sitting next to you would likely be smoking a cigarette for the entire flight. Right. And women weren't allowed to sit on juries, I don't think, when I was born. And we can't even imagine those things
right,
now.
Within your lifetime.
Yeah, within mm-hmm. my lifetime.
Mm-hmm. However, I think that part of the problem now is we know so much. We mm-hmm. see these pictures and these pictures of our own crisis maybe we've helped to cause and other crises and disasters and tragedies and terrible headlines, and they come into our living rooms and they come straight into our heads. And, you know, so there's a sense in which I think that the information we have can also debilitate us. And I'm feeling that that's true with, you know, you're saying that we are getting some things right, but we've never known so much about ecological catastrophe as we're learning now. And as the awareness, as consciousness goes up about this now, there's this glut, right, of explaining to us how bad it is. How do you think about that, and how people should live with the enormity of this knowledge?
Well, I have no idea how they should live. I wouldn't tell anybody else. I know for myself, I need to consider hope to be a renewable option. If I run out of it at the end of the day, well, then when I get up in the morning, I put it on with my shoes. I don't have another choice because I have kids. If I give up on fixing what's wrong with the planet, that's child abuse. I can't turn my back on my kids. And when my teenager, well, she just turned 20. When my older daughter sometimes confides in me that she's worried her generation won't be able to fix this big environmental damage, I say, you know what? It's not up to your generation. It's up to mine. We have a now or never kind of problem on our hands. And it is scary. It is overwhelming right now because we're really getting the bad news. We've had the privilege of ignoring
and listening to the bad news.
Yeah, we've had the privilege of ignoring the bad news for a really long time. So what happens, you know, when you don't pay your your credit card debt, you get socked. Okay, so we are getting socked. We have a tendency to blame anybody, but especially the government, and say, well, the government needs to fix this. Well, here's the trouble. The government is us. We have the laws that we allow, that we're willing to put up with. Many other, I'd say almost all other industrialized countries have taken enormous steps to limit their fossil fuel consumption, to put caps on their carbon emissions. As a country, we've been very frightened about doing that. We're terrified of sacrifice, it seems. We're really afraid of giving up the things that we're accustomed to. This is why I felt that an experiment like ours, my family's, in which we really tried to find a sustainable diet for ourselves for 1 year, was a wonderful exercise to discover that in fact, we can live with what people would call less. It turned out to be not less, but just different and wonderful. And I think that in order to accept limits at a legal level, sort of imposed at the national level, we are individually going to have to experiment with limits that we impose on ourselves personally.
Right, starting with ourselves.
Starting with ourselves. Mm-hmm. Right, starting with our own little lives and discovering that we can live in a different way. I think this is incredibly empowering, and it allows us to take the next step of, as a community, saying, yes, we will give up some things in order to make the world a cleaner, survivable place.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask if we have a hard stop at, we got started a little late. Do we have a hard stop at 2:30, or can we go 5 minutes? I just want to make sure I know how much time we have. Mitch, do you know? Okay. Can we keep going? Can we go for a couple of minutes over 3:30 if that, if we're,
are you
in the
asking
middle?
Me?
Yes, I am. I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
It's okay with me.
Right.
I don't see the engineer.
Okay.
So
okay. I know we've almost been going an hour, and I won't keep you longer than that. But anyway,
I'm enjoying it.
Good. And it seems to me that one thing you do in your work, one thing you offer as an antidote, if you will, to despair, is simply perspective. You know, you have this sentence. And I think we've all experienced this at some time. Wildness puts us in our place. And there's something liberating about that for human beings, although it's, again, counterintuitive in our culture. And I wanted to ask you, you know, with that in mind, my favorite passage in the Poisonwood Bible, which is your novel about a missionary family in post-colonial Africa, is where Ada Price, did you say her name like that, Ada?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But you can say it however you
okay.
want.
Okay, well, she's raised there and mm-hmm. and then becomes a scientist and goes back to Africa. Mm-hmm. And there's this section, I'm going to just read a little bit of it, if I can find it here. Okay, all right. Where she is looking at the natural world in Africa, she says, as a teenager reading African parasitology books in the medical library, I was boggled by the array of creatures equipped to take root upon a human body. I'm boggled still, but with a finer appreciation in the partnership. Back then, I was still a bit appalled that God would set down the barefoot boy and girl dollies into an Eden where presumably he had just turned loose elephantiasis, and microbes that eat the human cornea. Now I understand God is not just rooting for the dollies. Now, I have reflected a lot on that passage as I think about things that have happened in our culture the last few years, including the debate, the renewed, I think more isolated than the headlines would lead us to believe, but the renewed clash between biblical perspectives on life and scientific perspectives on life. You're an evolutionary biologist. This is connected, I think, to what we're talking about, because I think that, to me, that passage is one of the greatest paragraphs reconciling life as it is with what we know of science and with what we can imagine of religion. But what I hear is, let me. So I spoke with a scholar of Darwin a couple of years
mm-hmm.
ago.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he said is he thinks that this clash between science and religion recurs at moments in history where people are frightened, where the world is just seems out of control and complex. You know, that's what you and I have been describing.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
I agree with that. We think we're so smart, we humans. You know, we're just top-heavy hominids walking around in shoes thinking we own the place. And then, what do you know? We discover that we are animals, indeed, subject to the same biological laws as everything else, subject to the same physics. Yep, gravity still applies to us. Mm-hmm. If we trip, we're going to fall down. We hate that, I guess, but it sort of puts us in our place. But I happen to think it's also a wonderful place to be as a creature among creatures. I think one of the most glorious things about doing something as simple as going to the farmer's market or going to a U-pick operation, going to visit a farm and picking your own food, is to realize that it's a really wonderful thing to be an animal living in a habitat, being a part of a food chain. There's this enormous comfort and belonging to a cycle, and to see that food isn't a product but a process. This terror of the unknown becomes much more manageable when we accept that, yes, we are our biology. We really are what we eat, and it actually really tastes good.
What stories are you looking at now, or telling your children, or writing about, that are helping you continue to make sense of what you learned in this year that you describe in your new book, and the larger issues of the world we live in right now as you look out at that? It's kind of a hard question, maybe. It's so direct.
I think one of the great things that we did learn from this year was gratitude. Mm-hmm. The practice of being grateful for what the world gives us every day. That's one of the most important gifts I try to remember to reinforce for my kids all the time, and they're very good at it. I mean, actually, sometimes they remind me. And the other is optimism. I think we don't stand a chance unless we really know how to hope for the best.
You know, I'm comforted. You do confess somewhere that like every other adult you know, or most other adults you know, you do have your own worries, and that you write, you have a tendency to feel like a jerk for falling short of absolute conversion. I'm comforted. I think your book kind of sets up a model that feels daunting to me as a reader, and that might feel daunting to others. Are you having that reaction or experience?
Sorry. Well, no, I didn't. We didn't really. It wasn't that hard, and we didn't strive for any kind of purity. And mm-hmm. It's funny that before people read the book, they say, "Oh, well, weren't you tempted to cheat?" And "Oh, what are you eating on book tour?" And you know, stuff like that. Well, there is no cheating. An exercise in purity. We decided to do things like get fair trade coffee. We did get some things from outside of our community because we wanted a happy life. We thought if we can keep 95% of our food dollars inside our own community, how wonderful would that be? And we didn't want to tell a story that other people would look at and say, "Oh, how heroic they were. I could never do that." I didn't really, of course, imagine anybody would else do exactly what we did. I mean, mm-hmm. we're sort of crazy. We have a huge garden, and frankly, other gardeners are crazy too.
Right.
I think it's in our DNA. But on the contrary, we wanted to do something that really, really seemed doable in some part. So it surprises me that I very frequently encounter people sort of beating themselves up, saying, "Oh, well, I have to have, you know, at least sometimes raspberries in January." Well, that's fine. As long as we can begin to understand that it's an indulgence to ask
right.
someone
well,
to fly
for me,
raspberries to us in an airplane,
you know. That's not actually the, that's not what feels hard to me. And I think like a lot of people, I'm becoming gradually just more conscious of this and, mm-hmm. you know, in fact, mm-hmm. not desiring raspberries out of season or peaches mm-hmm. in February.
Because they're horrible.
Rather
fact,
horrible.
They're mushy.
Right. It's more the incredible dedication, you know, the totality of the effort you made.
Well, in part, like, give me an example, because I mean, I didn't think we were that dedicated.
Well, just that you really handed your lives over to this.
Well,
for a period of time.
We really didn't. I only wrote about of the million things that happened to us in that year, most of them didn't go into the book. Mm-hmm. You know, our dog died, for example, and I broke my leg. You know, all kinds of things happened that I didn't write about because for one thing, they're not. They belong to us, but mainly they're not relevant.
Your daughter went away to college. That's also exactly. Something that she kind of tucks into as an aside.
Uh-huh. Right. And frankly, that was a huge component of our emotional landscape. But this isn't really a memoir. Mm-hmm. This is a story about finding a certain path home. And so as a writer, I'm very disciplined about looking at the landscape of facts and picking out the ones that really move the story forward. So this really is a story about things we did that related to local food. But, you know, if I'm thrown in everything, you would see us just wander around in every direction. But But I didn't, because that would be a blog.
Okay. All right. Well, no, and I get that. But I do think there is something edifying in that. I mean, what you're saying is you did this. I really do think this was an act of discipline and an attempt to look at the ethics and morality of food, as well as, you know, the great irony we talked about as well, that that the ethical thing to do with food is also pleasurable. But you're also saying that life went on and life had its pitfalls and foibles.
Sure it did. Mm-hmm. Sure it did. And I'm sorry. I stepped on what you were going to say, but and now I completely lost my thought. I'm sorry. I'm so glad this isn't life.
I wouldn't do that.
Oh, I know. Really? Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. what we were really looking for, without knowing this, is a paradigm shift. And that always takes discipline in the beginning. Mm-hmm. It's just like taking a marriage vow or something. You know, in the beginning, you stand up in front of, you know, God and everybody, and you say, forsaking all others, and you talk about how everything's going to change. And at first, it might feel rather strained and artificial. Ultimately, it simply becomes your life. And you don't sit around thinking about, oh, well, when I was single, you know, I didn't have to pick up my shoes or whatever. That's how it was. We kind of made these vows. We are going to look really hard for a different way to eat. And so that meant on the first Saturday of the farmer's market, even though it was snowing, it was a horrible day outside. I really would like to have just curled up with a book. But we said, well, no, we're going to do this thing, and there's almost nothing in the pantry, so we have to do it. That was forced. And it was so rewarding. We found so much more there than we expected. And that's the day, right away, that I understood that sometimes you have to push yourself into a new way of thinking to get to a place where you want to be that's very comfortable, that doesn't even feel like work. Hmm. It's just a shift. You know, momentum in our habits can be enormous, and sometimes it just takes some sort of a formal vow to get us from one kind of thinking into another. Mm. And then it's easy. I'm telling you, it wasn't that hard.
All right, I'm listening. Well, I think I've taken enough of your time. I really appreciate this. I've wanted to speak with you for a long time. And
I'm so glad. I really enjoyed it.
Good. Okay. Well, thank you so much, and we'll be in touch with what we're doing with the show. I've actually just had a book out, and I've been touring, and we haven't been in full production for a little while, so we're catching our breath here, and I don't know exactly what our schedule is going to be.
I feel your pain.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and good luck to you on this book tour.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.